It's great seeing so many people here that I don't see so often. I haven't seen, don't see so often. Okay, that's it. I try to be polite. Okay, so what I want to do this coming year is Shemitah in Israel, and some of us hopefully will get to Israel at some point. Some of us have relatives in Israel, and. I can't comment about COVID in Israel. That's not my, I know there are new things going on every day, but I can't comment about that. But one of obviously the issues about Shemitah is what type of produce we buy, a lot of different rules. And I want to try to make this sort of a big picture as possible without getting so many technical details here. But just try to understand, there are just different terms and some basic understanding of what Heter Mechira is, oats are based in. Those are the terms that people generally throw out in terms of how people can plant or eat plant and harvest and buy crops. And some people use heter mechira, what's called, and some people use what's called oats are based in. There are other possible solutions. I want to sort of just go and just discuss terms. We're familiar with the language and try to understand the benefits of each approach. I want to try to also cover not only halacha, but also maybe a little bit hashkafa, the issue of, you know, this legal fiction of we're selling the land, wink, wink, we're buying it back a little later to the Arabs. What does Judaism have to say about that? And perhaps some other, you know, related type of issues like this. So again, after just a brief history, about after the 1881 pogroms, so then many disillusioned maskilim, like Moshe Leib Lilienbaum, parents Smoletskin, joined what's called the Chibat Zion movement. This began in the 1860s. The leaders were called the Chovevei Zion. And this association of people who loved Zion, of Zion, changed the character of the Zionist movement in the beginning of the 1880s, and it became much more secular. And the goal of this Chibat Zion movement was not political. It was to encourage Aliyah. Okay? So the goal was, in the beginning of the 1880s, we want Jews from Eastern Europe to make Aliyah. And there were some great rabbis who supported this, like the Netziv, the Malbim, the Beis Halevi, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Rav Shmuel Molliver. Rav Molliver was an open-minded East European Orthodox rabbi. He was the founding leaders of the Chovevei Zion movement, and he helped secure funding from Baron Rothschild to support the first settlements. So from 1881 to 1903, this is often referred to as the first Aliyah of Chovevei Zion. And seven moshavot, seven of these rural settlements were established in Eretz Yisrael, including Ekron in 1883, later named Maskeret Batya, in memory of Baron Rothschild's mother. And the first modern Shemitah in 1882 was, at that point in time, there were only a handful of Jewish farmers in Eretz Yisrael. They generally observed Shemitah. And there was some literature about rabbis allowing people to sell the field to non-Jews. But the first time that the issue of Shemitah really came up was in 1889, 5649. There was a large Jewish agricultural presence in Eretz Yisrael. And many farmers were concerned that if we don't have a solution to the Shemitah problem, if we don't work on the land, then the whole Israeli settlement will collapse, and other people will not make Aliyah. So Baron Rothschild supported many of these settlements, met with Rav Shmuel Salant, the chief rabbi of the Ashkenazic community in Yerushalayim in April and May of 1888, and he reported afterwards that he's going to follow Rav Salant's directive, that they're not going to work on the fields during the Shemitah year. By October, though, he changes his mind. He quotes, he thought that idleness for so long a period would ruin most of his young settlements. So he sent three administrators of the settlements to Rav Shmuel Salant to ask if there are any halachic solutions. So in other words, what did he do? He went rabbi shopping, right? You don't get the answer you want from Rav Shmuel Salant. So he wanted to find out, maybe there are other solutions. So he sent three administrators to Rav Shmuel Salant. He said, there's no solution. So what does he do? He goes to another rabbi. Okay, he goes to Rabbi Yeshua Lev Diskin, the Maral Diskin, and Rabbi Yeshua Lev Diskin said, no. But Baron Rothschild lived in France, and he was not going to take no for an answer. He approaches Rav Tzadok Khan, the chief rabbi of Paris, to find a solution, and Rav Khan turns, but if you have a solution, you can't have a low-level, mid-level rabbi who supports a solution. You need someone atop gadol, recognized leading halakhic authority. So Rav Khan goes to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector of Kovna, Lithuania, who was a top tier halakhic posek. And Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, you know, YU was initially named. Rietz is Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. It's Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. So he concludes that you can halakhically sell the land to the Arabs. But he is hesitant to be the sole halakhic authority to issue an authoritative ruling. That's very important. You see, and sometimes people say, why didn't rabbis need to have more broad shoulders to take certain stands? And certain rabbis take certain stands, and some rabbis don't. Even rabbis who have the authority, perhaps, to do so, if it's such a major issue that's going to affect, you know, traditional Judaism, they generally want other rabbis to support their position as well. I think when Rabbi Willa came here a number of years back, if you remember when he spoke about the prenup, the halachic prenup, where he came up with the solution, so he didn't say, I think it's legitimate, so it's good. He got about five or six other heavyweights to support, halakhic heavyweight, to support that as well, to gives it, that's generally what responsible poskim do, is that they try to get others, again, if they believe it's good, then probably some of their colleagues will also think it's good. So Rav Shmuel Molivar, one of the religious supporters of the Chovei Tzion movement, encouraged Rav Spector to meet other rabbis. He went to Warsaw, he met with the Rav Yeshua Trunk of Kutno, and Rav Shmuel Zanvil Klapfish, the chief rabbi of Warsaw, to try to agree to a halachic leniency to work, so they can work the fields during Shemitah. They reached an agreement that the land would be sold to non-Jews, that non-Jews could work the land, and Jews can only perform agricultural labors that were forbidden rabbinically. Because the truth is, on Shemitah, so the only types of work that is forbidden is planting, pruning, reaping, and picking the fruit. Those are only biblical prohibitions. I'm not going to get into all the details about this, but there are only four different types of malachos. They're the most important ones. You're planting, you're pruning, you're harvesting, and you're picking the fruit. So those are forbidden, but there are other types of agricultural labors that help maintain the fields. So the ruling they came up with is that non-Jews perform those prohibitions that are forbidden from the Torah. Jews can perform those acts that are only forbidden rabbinically, and they could sell the land to the non-Jews so that there's no sanctity of Shemitah. Remember, in Shemitah, there are two different issues. One is how you view the land, and number one, can you work the land? So in other words, on the one hand, they want to sell the land to non-Jews, so there's no holiness of the land. And in addition, even if it belongs to non-Jews, they also want that no Jews are working the land for malacha that is biblical. So in any case, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, he's known as the rabbi to come up with the big heter mechira. Rav Kook comes 20 years later. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector is known. He's the one who came with his historic decision. He allows the selling of the land to non-Jews, and that only non-Jews can perform these malachos. The Sephardi rabbis supported this. In October of 1888, thirty of the most prominent Ashkenazic rabbis of Yerushalayim issued a proclamation entitled Kol Mehechal, a call from the palace. It was a call to arms to defend the traditional way of life, and appealed to Jews from around the world to contribute funds to support the farmers who valiantly observed Shemitah. They were opposed to this leniency. just Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. You've heard of him, right? The Hirsch commentary of the Chumash. Seems to be a very modern rabbi, right? He's running to secular education. You know, sometimes we try to put rabbis in a box. But either they are traditional, they're traditional, so they don't subscribe to anything modern, which the Heter Mechira, that's a modern type of invention. That's saying that's doing something different than we would have otherwise done. So we tend to think that, let's say, all modern rabbis think one way and all traditional rabbis think another way. That's obviously not all the case. You have to analyze each issue independently. And Rav Hirsch, for example, say he was not in favor, for example, of the Heter Mechira. However, not enough money. They said, okay, we need to support the farmers, okay, but they didn't fundraise well enough. And in any case, there was a lot of tension in that first Shemitah year. Were these farmers who did, there? And there were some farmers who didn't work. There were some religious farmers who didn't work, and some people called them lazy, and some people called them God-fearing individuals. 20 years later, there were many more agricultural settlements, and they were even more secular, and Rav Kook supported and strengthened the Heter Mechira. So what I want to discuss with you today from a halachic, a very like overview, just the base, so we understand the basic issues, which are, what is the basis of the Heter Mechira, and what are other options if we should not rely on it? So we're going to discuss, we're going to discuss three halachic issues. The Heter Mechira relies on three issues, and then we're going to discuss another alternative, and then we're going to discuss hashkafically, is this legal fiction appropriate or not? Okay, so Heter Mechira, we're going to learn three things today. Okay, Heter Mechira rests on three assumptions. The first assumption that these rabbis used for the Heter Mechira is what? That nowadays Shemitah is only rabbinic. If it's Torah, generally speaking, if you can knock something down to a rabbinic prohibition, you have a lot more room to play with, in general in Judaism. Right? In general, if you can knock down, like, you know, for financial needs or whatever, all these different leniencies, if you can knock something down to a rabbinic prohibition, there's a lot more rabbinic room to play with. If you can't knock it down, then it's more difficult. So one major assumption is that Shemitah nowadays is rabbinic. And the question is, why would you say Shemitah nowadays is rabbinic? Any thoughts? Why would Shemitah be rabbinic nowadays? What would make it... There's no state? What do you mean? Okay, so we're talking pre-Medinat Yisrael. So does it depend on the Beis HaMikdash? What else might it depend on? What else? What? The kingdom. Okay, so the truth is, the Rambam is of the opinion that the Rambam in source one, this, we're going to do this very high, like we're not going to go into, I don't know if we'll read every source, but the Rambam writes that the Chi of Aretz B'Shmita of Masros, okay, the obligation nowadays of Shmita and Maaser, that's tithing produce, the same rules as Truma, okay? And Truma, right, Truma is the, if you have a field, you give a certain amount to the Kohen, that's Truma. You give other food to the Levi, that's Maaser. But for our purposes, the Rambam in Source 2 says that, he says the following, he says that Truma only applies Bizman, Shekol Yisrael Sham, Shenemar, Ki Tavo Bias Kulcha. That the requirement is not a Beis HaMikdash, it's not a Jewish state, it's not the government. The requirement for Shemitah is that we all live there. Now, it doesn't mean all, but it means majority. Well, that's what it seems to be. So the Shemitah nowadays is only rabbinic because, or at least in the end of the 19th century, Shemitah is only rabbinic. Why? Because most Jews don't live in Israel. There's only a requirement for some of these rules from a Torah perspective if most of the Jews live in Israel. Why might that soon present a problem? That might not longer be the case. Right. So in other words, it's interesting that in the end of the 19th century, so Shemitah was clearly only rabbinic according to most Rishonim. There are different opinions about this. Some say not everyone agrees to this, but I would say most halachic authorities believe that Shemitah nowadays is rabbinic, because most Jews don't live in Israel. So the question is that going to change? You know, when Helene and Marty, are they going to break it now to 50% when they move? Okay, are they going to? I know we're almost there, right? So
what's the current population now?
I don't know exactly, but it's close. It's close. It's very close. Bottom line is that it may not even make a difference, because the Rashba, I just quoted the Rashba, who says the following, and so I'm just going to say it outside. The Rashba says in Maseches Gittin, he was arguing on another commentary who said that at the time of the Beis Hamikdash, he held that at the time of the second Beis Hamikdash even, Shemitah was not a Torah obligation, even time of second Beis Hamikdash. And you're going to say, time of second Beis Hamikdash, well, did most Jews come back? Did they not come back? But he's saying it's irrelevant, because it's not only that most Jews live in Israel, but that the Shvatim, the tribes, are living where they're supposed to live. So we're good. I mean, it's not good, but bottom line is that you can move any case. It's fine, you can move any case. But the bottom line is that according to many Rishonim, until, and that's the accepted position, that Shemitah, until majority of Jews live in Israel, and the tribes are living where they should be living, so then there's no, it's not a Torah obligation, it's only rabbinic, and you have a lot more room to play with. So you might ask, by the way, are the tribes ever going to come back, right? So I actually asked this question too. So when I was in Israel, about a month ago, so Rav Rimon, Rav Yossi Tzvi Rimon, he is a prominent Rav in the Gush, and he is like the authority on Shemitah. Like I think there's even a book that he put out, one in English and in Hebrew, and he is like the authority, okay? And so so I asked him that question. I said, well, like, are Jews coming back? Because there are 10 lost tribes, so we're never going to get it back. So he said to me, it makes sense, I think, that when, you know, the northern kingdom was expelled or was exiled about 140 years before the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, right? You know, the first Beis Hamikdash destroyed in 586 BC. That's the southern, you know, kingdom. And then the northern kingdom, the 10 lost tribes, as they say, so they're exiled 140 years before. So he pointed out that, yeah, most of them left, but there are probably some who escaped south, and they're probably living amongst us. So in the, and you know, some people say in different parts of Afghanistan, there's different, you know, yeah, I'm sure some of you have done some, seen videos of different people who've, or different people claim that they're different groups of Jews who claim descent from certain tribes. So whether that's true or not, I don't know. But the point is that presumably there are some Jews, not a lot, most Jews nowadays, either from Shevet Levi or Yehuda or Binyamin, from the southern tribes. But presumably there were some from the north who did come down to the south. But in the future, in the Messianic era, there will be Jews. We're going to have, hopefully, majority of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. And we're going to have also... the tribes are going to come back to their place. So because that doesn't exist right now, Shemitah is only rabbinic. So that's assumption number one. Okay, that's the first thing. We do three things here with the Heter Bechira. So the first thing is that it's only Drabana nowadays, because most Jews don't live in Israel. And even if they would, the tribes aren't in their place. Okay? The second question is, if we sell land to a non-Jew, does the land lose its status of holiness? Like, can you do that? Can I take land, like the land, right? In other words, the land in Israel has kedusha, has sanctity, it has holiness. So that means all of the agricultural laws apply, right? Kids, some of your kids may live in Israel, right? So they know if they have farms or whatever, then they have to, you know, they have crops that they have to separate some, and you know, for truma, maser. So there are different rules. So the question is: any crops that are in Israel, whatever we call Israel, biblical Israel, is it, or we have to, that's another issue. What's defined as Israel? What are the boundaries? That's another question. But let's say, are any crops that grow in Israel, or is any land that's in whatever we call Israel, is that subject to laws of Shemitah? Or does it have to be, number one, in Israel and owned by a Jew? Right? So in other words, the assumption of the Heter Bechira is what? That for something to be subject to the laws of Shemitah, it not only has to be in Israel, but it also has to be owned by a Jew. And just to give you an example, the Rambam in Source 4, so the Rambam says, a non-Jew who buys land in Israel, the land doesn't lose its status of holiness, and therefore, if the Jew repurchases it, so then the laws of Shemitah apply. That's what the Rambam writes. And Rav Yosef Cairo in Source 5, he basically says what the Rambam is really saying. He's saying what the Rambam is really, is that, yeah, if I sell my land to the non-Jew and then I repurchase it, it still has the laws of Shemitah. But if I just sell it to him, so then it loses its status of Shemitah. It's no longer Kadosh, right? There are others, the Mabit. So these are rabbis who argued on Rav Yosef Cairo, who said that even if I sell my land to the non-Jew, it's in Israel, it still has holiness, it's still subject to the laws of Shemitah. So you said you have this debate here again, right? If I sell my land to the non-Jew, is it no longer subject to the laws of Shemitah or not? That's the second question. But there's a line of thinking, the Sefer HaTrumah, who says the following, who says in Source 7, Nucha lomar dibishvis bizman hazeh shehim midrabanan, Mutter lachosh lizro bekarka akum afilu midrabanan. So there are some who say, so we have this high level debate. If I sell the land in Israel to a non-Jew, is it still subject to laws of Shemitah? So the Sefer Truma says that if Shemitah is nowadays only, remember I said if something's only drabanan to begin with? If Shemitah nowadays is not on a Torah level, it's only on a rabbinic level, then we can play with it more. So there are many rabbis who believe that because Shemitah to begin with is only rabbinic, it's not a Torah obligation. So now I can sell it to a non-Jew. And even those rabbis who think that if you sell it to a non-Jew, maybe it still retains its holiness. But since Shemitah is only derabbanan, only rabbinic obligation nowadays, so you can sell it to a non-Jew. So now you see what I'm saying. In other words, we have two different assumptions. Number one is that Shemitah nowadays is only rabbinic. And number two is that it loses its holiness when you sell it to a non-Jew. Okay, both of those points, there is some debate about. But the Heter Bechira rests on those two assumptions. Okay, does that make sense? Any questions? Okay, no? No? Okay. So one more assumption. There's one more assumption that this relies on. Yeah.
Is this not ever based on the fact that you can buy it back and not buy it back, like a common type of sale, or once you sell it,
even if you sell it for a year or two, then it's considered valid. It's still a valid thing. That's more of like a legal fiction. Is that appropriate to play with that? Like, when you sell chametz, right? So it's a whole, it seems like it's a joke. I'm selling to you, I'm going to buy it back. So I'm going to deal with that piece a little bit later. So you'd have to sell, okay, I think you have to sell it, but I'm going to repurchase it. I'm not sure the answer to your question, but I believe you could say that I'm selling it for $1 million and I'm going to repurchase it $1 million a year from now. So it's not the same as, I don't know the answer to your question, it'd be a lease for a sale. What do you say?
What if he doesn't want to get it back?
Right, so you have to, so it's the same issue with the chametz, right? So it's the same issue with the chametz, right? No, why do you know that? No, so so the difference would be, I believe with the non-Jew, you can sell it for a period of time. You actually can sell it for, so it's sort of like a lease, but you can sell it for a period of time to the non-Jew. Yeah.
Decision-making authority right. From a business point of view.
Yeah. So, right. So this is a question. There was a whole discussion that the Chazon Ish didn't agree with the sale because it wasn't registered. Right? Because it wasn't registered. It wasn't registered. It wasn't recorded. So there was a discussion whether it's valid even if it's not recorded. But the bottom line is like I can get the profit as long as I don't own the land. So it does seem like a legal fiction to some extent. There's he owns the land for that period of time, but I can still make the profits.
And is that
it's different. It's different than let's say for Shabbos. So it's a partnership for Shabbos. So there right? Like if you have a partnership with someone for Shabbos, so question: could you do it? But if you make that partnership, you're saying that all the profits go to this. To the non-Jew. Here you're not saying that. Here you say the land is owned by the non-Jew for, you know, for a year or whatever it is.
Does that inform the discussion about whether this should be viewed as a total fiction or should?
Yeah. So it is legal. It is. So the Chazon Ish had an issue with this. I'm going to get to this actually. I'm going to get to this point. We can talk about it now.
If I were analyzing something as a lawyer, not sure. Properly, but as a lawyer, if what defines ownership?
Right.
If I have all of the benefits right. and the decision making.
Right. So I don't think you have all the benefits. No, in other words, you don't have the right to. Let's say, for example. If I sell to a non-Jew, I don't have the right to then lease the land or sell the land to someone else at that point. I don't have all the benefits of ownership.
Can he sell the land to somebody else?
So I don't know the answer of how that works, but I'm sure the way it works is that after Shemitah, it's sold back to the other person, but he has whatever right. You know, I lose rights of ownership. And I'll point it out right now that the Chazon Ish said that the sale was not recorded. So it's not legal. So Rav Drukman, who is a religious Zionist rabbi, he's Rosh Hashiv of Or Etzion, when he was a Chaver Knesset, when he was a minister in Knesset, so he established the Chok HaShmita, which states that the sale is recorded. It's an Israeli law that the sale is legal even though it's not recorded. Normally, sale of land has to be recorded, and they passed the law saying that this is a valid, you know, binding law. I don't know all the details of what happens if the land gets destroyed, who bears the loss, but for that, in other words, for that, those perspectives, it belongs to the non-Jew for that year, for that period of time. There's a distinction between the land belonging to him and who the prophets belong to. The prophets of the, you know, the yeah.
If he's selling it to a non-Jew, what obligation does this non-Jew have to do harvest according to Jewish law?
Oh, he has no obligation. So to some extent, that was a great point. To some extent, we're sort of like hedging our bets. In other words, right, if you believe that the Heter Bechira totally works completely, then you sell to non-Jew, a Jew could do, all the laymen could do everything. So because the way halacha works sometimes is that there's a debate about this issue, and there's a debate about this issue, this issue, this issue, so we try to minimize the risk that there is a halachic problem. So number one is we're going to sell to the non-Jew. Number two, we're taking the position that Shemitah is only rabbinic. Number two, we're saying that we're selling to the non-Jew. And number three, just to be on the halachic safe side, because some rabbis still have as a problem for Torah prohibitions to work the land, so that we don't have Jews work on land. And by the way, it's a very important point, because for those people, let's say, who are against the Heter Mechira, you have to understand that there are many secular Jews who rely on the Heter Mechira. And what that means is many secular Jews who care less about halacha, they're willing to go through with this and say, you know what, I'll have non-Jews work the fields. So you're saying, okay, we're not going to rely on the Heter Mechira. Well, they're going to work the land anyway. So sometimes You know, some people may not like the Heter Bechira because I don't agree to this, this, and this. But because of the Heter Bechira, you'll have many, you know, secular Jews who don't care about halacha, but they're actually following the Jewish law, and sometimes they may even agree to have non-Jews work the land. I'm sorry, right? So my point is, technically, you could have, if you really believe that it works 100%, you could have Jews work the land. But that's since it's a question, we try to minimize the halachic risk, as it were. Okay? So the last issue, right? So again, so we have two definite, right? The first two issues are what? Number one, Shemitah nowadays may only be rabbinic. Number two is that when you sell it to the non-Jew, it's not subject to laws of Shemitah. So, okay, and the third issue is, are you allowed to sell land to a non-Jew? I'm nervous about this, right? Because this may appear to be racist, right? To make a comment, can you sell to non-Jew? Okay, so halachically, what is that permitted? Is it not permitted? So you would say, well, why aren't you allowed to sell to non-Jew? There's a Gemara which says, Lo Sechadeim, is a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Chaf Amud Aleph, it's source 8. He says, you're not allowed to, Lo Sechadeim. So what opinion is, Lo Titen Lehem Chariyah Bakarka. You should not give them a chance to encamp in Eretz Yisrael. Meaning what? They're saying that you have the rest of the world for other people. This is the land for the Jews, and so therefore you should not sell land to non-Jews. And there are discussions, by the way, I'm not going to talk about this now, but there are all these discussions where certain rabbis got into trouble where they said you can't rent out apartments to non-Jews, and they're accused of being racist. And so this is all based on this issue of, it's not only 21st century issue, this is an issue at the end of the 19th century, when you're selling the land to the non-Jew, is that a violation of Lo Sechadeim? We shouldn't give up land. We should buy land in Israel, and we should avoid selling land to non-Jews. And the reason for this, and I disagree with this, but the notion of trying to separate ourselves from the non-Jews is that we don't want to be influenced by the non-Jews. I guess this Gemara is written before the internet, where we suppose anyway the second. But the whole notion. The whole notion, if you read through the Torah, there's a Moshe's warning the Bnei Israel of what? Of don't get influenced by the local tribes. And that you have a different vision of ethics and morality and holiness than the locals. So therefore, you should separate yourself from them. And it should only, so obviously that you want to have less influence. So you have less influence if only Jews are living in Eretz Yisrael. If you have idolaters living in Eretz Yisrael, so that might influence you to become an idolater, for example. So the question is, the Heter Bechira assumes that you're allowed to sell this land to a non-Jew. And there are a number of reasons given as to why we say that you're allowed to, those who allow it. So, for example, the Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says that only applies to a permanent sale. Here you're selling it for a year, or maybe a little more than a year. So it's a temporary sale. So that's not a violation of selling the land to a non-Jew. Rav Cook said that the prohibition of selling to a non-Jew is because you're afraid of someone who is an idolater. Okay? So that's the issue. It's an issue of idolatry. So, Muslim, right, Islam is not an idolatrous religion. Christianity, it's a question. But Islam is not an idolatrous religion, so you're allowed to sell land to a non-Jew who's not an idolater. There's also another, Rav Zalman Shach said that there's only a prohibition to sell land to a non-Jew who already doesn't own property. Because what's the issue? The issue is we only want to keep, we don't want more idolaters or more people who can influence us negatively to move into Eretz Yisrael. But if they already own land in Eretz Yisrael, so then we can sell to them. So there were a number of rabbis who felt that you are allowed to sell. And if you think about it, there's a tshuva by the Yeshuos Malko. So he said the following. He said that, what's the reason why you shouldn't sell land to the to the Arabs, because we're afraid that it's gonna lose the Jewish character of the state of Israel. Right? You want basically Jews to live in Israel. This is our homeland, and you're afraid that it's gonna ruin the Jewish settlement by selling the land to non-Jews. The whole purpose of the Heter Mechira was what? Because if you don't allow the Heter Mechira, what's going to happen? All the settlements will collapse. Right. So in other words, the philosophy behind not selling to the non-Jews does not really apply here, because the reason why you're selling it is you're trying to create a legal fiction, whatever, or a loophole, to allow the settlements to be able to flourish so that we can have so Jews can live and we can create this Zionist entity, which ended up being Medina Israel. But there were some who disagreed. The Netziv disagrees, the Chazon Ish, later on, he came much later, he disagreed with Heter Mechira. What's interesting is that he said, the Chazon Ish said, I disagree with the Heter Mechira. He came in the 1930s, I believe. And he said, you could eat food. Initially, he said, that even though I think the sale is a sin, because you're not allowed to sell land to non-Jews, but after the fact, you are allowed to eat the food. You could, you could say the sale is, I believe, is not legal. I'm sorry, the sale is forbidden, but once it's sold, then it's legal. It's halachically legal. Right? There's certain things that you can't do, but once it's done, it's effect. But then he changed his mind. And he said there's a principle of Ein shliach lidvar avera. There's no agent, there's no agency for a sin. Meaning what? He's saying that if I own land, right? If I'm a farmer and I go to you and you're the agent selling to the Arab, and I say, can you sell this land on my behalf? He said, I'm asking you to commit a sin. So therefore, this action is invalid. So the Chazon Ish basically was against the whole Heter Mechira. You should know that later Shemitah sales have dealt with this. That basically the farmers, basically the way it works, the farmers sell. Let's say, Mandy, you're the land authority. You're in charge of the land authority. So I would sell it to you directly. Okay, I would sell it to you directly. All the farmers sell to you, and then you would deal with the Arabs. So that would deal with this. But the bottom line is, the assumption that the Heter Mechira works is based on these three assumptions. So, basic things to leave the shir. Sometimes you hear a lot and we forget a lot. So remember these three things, right? Heter Mechira works out, number one, that it's only rabbinic because majority of Jews don't live there. Any of majority Jews do live there. The tribes have not returned to their places. Number two, that when you sell the land, right, it loses its holiness. Again, that's a debatable point. And number three is that you're allowed to sell the land to the non-Jew, and it's not a violation of selling land to the non-Jew because you're doing it for the benefit. It's only for a time being. You're selling it to an Arab who doesn't believe in idolatry. So those are the three. So the Heter Mechira works on those three assumptions. Okay, so that is sort of many farmers rely on the Heter Mechira. I want to first compare it to another solution, and then we're going to say which is better, and we'll go through that. But the second solution is the following. That's what's called Otsar Beisdin. Okay, Otsar Beisdin. In 1933, when the Chazon Ish arrives in Israel, he sends Rav Kook a letter that he supports Otsar Beisdin. It has the support from a Tosefta, which is basically in Source 10. Basically, what it says in this Tosefta, my point is bringing the Tosefta, he says that at first the agents, we'll read it in English, the Tosefta, that's from the Mishnaic time. So this is not a made up, the Otsar Beisdin is not some kind of made up legal fiction. This is actually the times of the Mishnah where they said that the Beisdin would sit at the entrances of the cities. Whoever brought fruits in his hand, the Beisdin would take the fruits from him and would give him from them enough food for three meals. So in other words, basically people would give crops to the Beisdin, and the Beisdin would have workers to basically harvest crops and would give people to eat. In other words, it was Shemitah. What would people eat? So you would have the Beisdin, the courts, would hire workers The workers would, you know, bring the crops, give it to the Beis Din, and the Beis Din would give people food. The Beis Din would pay the workers for their service, and I guess the people who would buy stuff, they would pay the Beis Din. The way the Otsar Beis Din works is that on Shemitah, for Shemitah, you're not allowed. What for Shemitah, you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to like when you're selling it. So what are you doing? You're not allowed to harvest and pick. So here's my question, right? If you had these workers and the Beis Din basically told them, I want you to pick the crops and then you can give it to people. So they can. So aren't they violating the prohibition of picking the crops? So the answer is that the customer, you can't act like you own the crops. You can't plow, you can't pick the fruits and harvest the fruits like you own the crops. Meaning what? You can't sell the crops to buy crops, but you can pay someone for service. Okay? In other words, in the Tosefta, the people would pay money for what? They'd pay money for people to provide the service. Like there are these apples, and people would pick the apples. I don't think they had apples then. But they would pick the apples, and you're not paying for the apple. What are you paying for? You're paying for the service, for them to pick the apple, loading in their wagon, and bringing it to the store. And that is how Otsar Beis Din works. Otsar Beis Din works in that people are paying for the service and not for the crops. Okay? So in other words, and this is a Chazanis said, when customers are buying apples or whatever any crops that you're picking, you're paying they're getting money not based on the crops, but they're getting money based on the service. Rav Rimon said, he said that I can charge, I'm in charge of a store. I can charge you more money for a higher quality apple and you less money for a lower quality apple. But all the money that I get when I'm paying the workers, I'm only paying them for service and not for their crops or products. In other words, the key, what? Yeah, they could be Jewish workers, and the owner can still own the land. In other words, if I'm a farmer and I want to use Otsar Beis Din, so here's the key to Otsar Beis Din. There are two aspects of farming. I'm not a farmer, but the two aspects. There's the planting to make the crops grow, and then once the crops grow, you harvest them, right? So there are two different aspects. Otsar Beis Din is a solution for the second aspect, for the harvesting. So basically, if you're Otsar Beis Din, so what are you doing? If I'm a farmer and I don't want to rely on Heter Mechira. I don't want to rely on Heter Mechira. So you know what? So basically, I harvest all my crops and I will get paid and my workers will get paid a flat fee based on service. You have to estimate, right? Based on service and not based on crops. No, see, that doesn't solve the planting problem. It only so they don't. That's a problem. There's no solution for that. It only solves half the problem. Otsar Beis Din only solves half the problem. Right, 100%. Yeah, it only solves. There are other solutions, greenhouses, but it only solves half the problem. And I think, as I understand, with the Otsar Beis Din, you have to buy into it because you're paying someone for services, regardless of how the crops turn out. So people pay in beforehand. But here's the fundamental difference between Otsar Beis Din and Heter Mechira. If you get Otsar Beis Din crops, it's holy. And then you have to, life is much easier for the Heter Mechira crops. Because, right, I can eat my apple, I don't want to eat my whole apple, I throw in the garbage. The Otsar Beis Din crops, so then that's holy fruit. So there you have to There you have to wait until the crops, if you're a business, so you have to wait until, like, you have an apple, a leftover apple, you have to wait until it gets decomposed, right? So they have a pach shvita. There's a whole process where you have a garbage, you have a bag where you put all the fruit in until it gets decomposed or whatever. It gets it's not fit for consumption at all, and only then can you throw it out. It's much more complicated. It's much more complicated, but it's holy fruit. Yeah, you can. So here's something very interesting, by the way. So it used to be, so the halacha, when it comes to fruit that has kedusha of Shemitah, you can only use it the way it's normally being used. So in the old days, they didn't make lettuce juice. But nowadays, they make juice out of everything, right? All types of crops. In the old days, they didn't do it. So nowadays, there's no problem of cooking or squeezing the juice out of anything, because basically, normally you have to use the holy fruit in a normal way. But nowadays, right, we experiment with everything, so everyone squeezes everything, even lettuce, as I've told. What? You can make a smoothie. I'm saying, in the old days, you had your five fruit that you made smoothies with. Now you make smoothies with everything. The key, right, so the key here is that when Rabbi Moniz explained this to us, he said, you know, that this is very special. I mean, it's, some people look at it as a pain. He's a very holy man. And he's saying it's very special because normally speaking, you have to go to Yerushalayim, you know, for holy stuff. You have to go, you know, for Maser. I'm saying Maser Sheni. In Mishnaic times, you wanted holy crops, you would have to go into Yerushalayim. Here, in the Shemitah, the holiness is in your houses. The holiness is wherever in your homes. And he said, this is what people are going to do when the Beis Hamikdash is built. And the Shvatim are back in their lands. That's what we're going to do. We're going to rely on Otzer Beis Din. We're not going to rely on the Heter Bechira when Shemitah is on a Torah level. So what we're doing now for Otzer Beis Din is what will be done in the times of the Beis Hamikdash. And the key with Otzer Beis Din is that you need to finish fruit until the end. And if there are leftovers, you put it in a bag and you place it in the garbage. And that's really you know what Otzer Beis Din is. So again, the key to understand of Otzer Beis Din is it only helps on the back end, not the front end. It doesn't help you plant, it doesn't help you plow. It only helps you if you have crops that grew, you know, and now it's the Shemitah year, and I'm not going to get into the timing of what's the Shemitah fruit. That's a discussion to itself. When does the year begin? When does the year end? Because, like, you know, how much is it grown? That's a discussion unto itself. But in terms of if something is Shemitah fruit and the people who are harvesting it and are collecting it and then bringing it to the stores, if they're getting paid for services and not based on the crop, not based on the product itself, that's called Otzer Beis Din. That's not based on any legal fiction. That is precedent even from Tannaitic times. Then it would have Kedushas Shemitah. One interesting point is that sometimes you'll get, you know, in America, you might, you know, you go to the kosher store and they'll have, like, let's say wine or whatever. And let's say it's, you know, by the way, so if you have oats are based in wine, so for Havdalah, you know, it spills over. You'd have to drink it up. You say you can't let, you'd have to, you can let it spill over, then drink it up from the plate. I mean, we have to do it in a, whatever, hygienic way. But the point is that you can't waste. But so there's the question. How do we end up with products here, right, that are Shemitah products there? So if it's a Heter Bechira, not a problem. There's no holiness to it, right? If it's Otzer Beis Din, there normally is a prohibition to export Shemitah, I mean, products that have Kedusha Shemitah. You're normally not allowed to export it. So the big question, sometimes you'll say, how can I find in a kosher store Otzer Beis Din wine? Right? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the OU gives Hashgacha to Heter Bechira stuff. I don't believe they do, but I'm not 100% sure. But oats are based in, so how can you find that in outside Israel? So there are a number of leniencies. Some poskim say that the purpose of this halacha is to support, as some say, that the purpose of this halacha is to support people living in Eretz Yisrael so that they can consume the produce. If there's extra produce, then, and that would go to waste, then you can export it. In other words, there is an issue. I'm just pointing out to you, there is an issue about exporting. You're not normally speaking, there's a halacha that Kedusha Shemitah, food that Kedusha Shemitah has to be consumed in Israel. So how do we get it outside Israel? There are some leniencies. One of them is that if normally speaking, what don't you want? You don't want to take Kedusha Shemitah and not give it to people in Israel who need it. And just export it. So if you make a lot of stuff, you're always exporting it. So there are many poskim who are lenient. So getting to the sort of the final, the real big question is: should we rely on heter mechira? Should we use otzar beis din? So one question, of course, is: do we need the heter mechira now? Now, there's again, you're working on three assumptions: the heter mechira, shemitah nowadays is drabbanan. Shemitah nowadays, there's no kedusha, no holiness when you sell it to the non-Jew. And number three, that you're allowed to sell to the non-Jew for a time being. So do we want to rely, you have to agree to all those arguments. Do you want to rely on that? Maybe only in the time that people say, well, 140 years ago or 120 years ago when the settlements were on the brink and there was a major financial need. So then we rely on Heter Mechira. Should we rely on it now? Can't Israeli society survive without resorting to this leniency? So when Rav Rimon spoke to us, so he told us that that's his view at least, he said that many farmers are not observant, and if we don't provide the Heter Mechira solution, many of them will work the fields like they would regularly. So now we provide a way that it's certainly a solution according to many halakhic authorities. Also, it's not so simple to tell a wholesaler or a retailer that you can't have crops for a year or to lay off workers for a year. You know, have these big companies, you know, oats are based in, it's not necessarily a solution for people. It's not just the farmer, it's the whole industry. So it's not always such a simple solution. And because there are many different aspects of selling the product. So it's not such a simple solution. Rav Rimon, by the way, he raises funds. I don't know if you see this, that people raise funds to support people who want to keep Shemitah. You know, in terms of, they have called Karen Shviz, and in order to support those who are doing that. At the end of the day, the fundraising efforts are not sufficient to allow these big companies to just take off a year. So it sort of depends, but he spends a lot of time fundraising so that people can keep it in its most optimal form. He, Rav Rimon, is of the opinion that it's better to rely on the Heter Mechira than to buy from the non-Jew. And to buy from the Palestinians, right? And as he feels that it's better to do that, there are others who disagree. But that's his viewpoint, right? And you know, some will say, I have some friends who say it's a big pain, right? The best thing would be to do the otzar beis din and just as your consumer. And to do all those different things, to bag it. So a friend of mine was telling me it's a big pain. So he's probably going to buy from the he hasn't relied on Heter Mechira, so he's going to probably buy for the non-Jew. Rav Rimon would say no, it's better to rely on Heter Mechira that we shouldn't. Listen, there are many products that we buy from people who support terror. There is trade between Israel and the Palestinians and a lot of products. But the key is you don't want to provide, his argument is you don't want to provide more than normal, for this. So he would rely on Heter Mechira, and others disagree. For him, he's like, I have an opportunity to do Kedusha Shviz. Like, he loves the opportunity of making all the different bags of the Pach Shemitah. Some people feel it's a pain, but for him, it's like, oh, I could do Kedusha. It's like, it's an inspiring level. So he asked the question, is it appropriate to rely on Heter Mechira as a haroma, as a loophole? So that was a question someone asked. So what's interesting is that I was thinking about this question on Shavuos night. So I spoke about the opinion of Rav Shachter. I think I repeat actually on Shavuos day also. I shared the opinion of Rav Herschel Shachter as to, is it appropriate to rely on halachic loopholes or not? Is it like, you can rely on it if need be, but really you shouldn't rely on halachic loopholes. Now, what's the Jewish view? What's the halachic view? Should rely on halachic loopholes with mechiras chametz and other such things. So the Rav Shachter makes the following distinction. He says the following. It depends if you're trying to get out of a prohibition or try to avoid fulfilling a positive mitzvah. That's the distinction he's making. If the Torah tells you that if you do X, like the Torah tells you, this is not really a loophole. The Torah tells you if you wear wool and linen together, right, then that's shatnez. So if I remove the linen threads, is that a loophole? It's not a loophole. It's just that the Torah says if you do X, so then you violate something. So if you don't do, if you make sure you don't violate X, you don't fit into that, you don't fit, follow those conditions, then that's totally fine. So there's no problem of following a halachic loophole when it comes to a prohibition. However, if the Torah provides you an opportunity to fulfill a positive mitzvah, and you go out of your way, because, you know, it's too much of a pain to fulfill the positive mitzvah, so that's not recommended. Like, for example, let's say, for example, you had a lunch and learn. And you're like, oh, I really want that bagel, but I don't want a bench. So I just have the, So that might be, okay, you may not want the bagel because all the carbs, it's something different. But I'm saying, if you avoid, it's not a loophole, but to create a loophole to avoid fulfilling, to doing a mitzvah positive, so that's not so recommended. That's the situation of Schechter Bay. If there's something that Torah says, don't do X, so okay, so I avoided doing X. There's no problem with that. But if I create a loophole, because I don't want to do something that God commanded me to do, because a mitzvah you to do, an opportunity to serve a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Well, I make a loophole so I can avoid that, that's not so recommended. That's what Schechter says. So the question, how would you apply that to Shemitah? So let's think about that. So the Heter Bechira. So I would say the following. The prohibition to work the land, there's a prohibition to work the land. So the Heter Bechira, if the sale is legitimate, then a farmer can use it to avoid the prohibition, and certainly if it's necessary from a financial perspective. However, I wouldn't have a problem. I don't have a problem like basically selling it to the non-Jew for a year and a few months. So the non-Jew owns it. You have no right to sell the land, to lease out the land. Again, you get all the profits. I have no problem, based on Rav Schechter's analysis, of saying there's a prohibition that you're not allowed to work the land if these conditions are met. So these conditions aren't met. So that's it. So I don't violate the prohibitions in the Torah. From a Kedusha Shvi's perspective, so it's an opportunity to observe the mitzvot of Eretz Yisrael nowadays. And it's a pain to store the fruit in the bags until they rot. It's a pain, but it's also an opportunity. Rav Rimon tells the story about how he was once giving a lecture somewhere in Manhattan. And he thought, oh, Manhattan, New York, kosher food, you know, obviously, you know, so it was lunchtime, so he said, I'm going to go out to find a kosher restaurant in Manhattan. So he goes out there, he thinks there's obviously going to be a kosher restaurant right down the block. And he didn't know, but he couldn't find one. He was starving. So he didn't know what to do. So he goes into this, convenience store. So you know it's kosher, it's not. So he sees there's an orange. He's about to take an orange. He looks at this orange and he says, Trumos and Masos? No. No. Kedusha Shvis? No. He looks at, it's just an orange. Yeah, I don't want it. For him, he lost his appetite because he is so in tune with the mitzvos that we now have the opportunity to keep for those who are in Eretz Yisrael, that he's like, an orange is not, for him it's not an orange. For him, an orange is an opportunity to fulfill, you know, different mitzvos. So again, I would say is the following. For the customer, if possible, again, it's more of a pain in terms of what you have to do. There seems to be, certainly, there's what to rely on for the Heter Mechira. But for the consumer, if possible, he should try to take advantage of this mitzvah and opportunity to achieve Kedusha with Eretz Yisrael. So it's true, the Otzar based it is more challenging because there are more rules. But I would say that is something that it might be appropriate. Again, it's easy for me to say. I'm not not going there. I'm probably going to go in January to visit Leora. But when she's studying in Eretz Yisrael, I hope that I'm going to try. Hopefully, I'll be able to live up to this. You know, it'll only be for a week or two. But to keep the laws of Otsar Beisdin, to observe the rules if possible. Not because there's necessarily anything wrong with Heter Bechira. Again, there are some who question it. But because you have opportunity to observe the Kedusha that only happens once every 7 years. And I was just inspired. We heard Rav Rimon. He's someone who really feels, again, he justifies Heter Bechira. We explained the reason. And we try to make it as legitimate halakhi as possible. A lot of the issues that the Chazon Ish and others had, we've dealt with. And he feels it's certainly a better option than supporting our neighbors who may want to do us harm. He's certainly in favor that is a better option. But for him, the best option is Otsar Beis Din, where you can observe the Kedusha as a customer. That seems to be the best option. Again, so this is a basic overview, again, without getting to many technical details. Again, we're discussing today the brief history of the Heter Bechira, the three assumptions of the Heter Bechira, and the little challenge, the Otsar Beis Din solution, how that works, and comparing the two.